this session of the Sunstone Symposium. Our guest speaker today is Dr. Ronald L. Numbers, professor of the history of medicine and the history of science at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. Professor Numbers was born in 1942 in Denver, Colorado. He received his BA in mathematics and physics from Southern Missionary College, his MA in history from Florida State University, and his PhD in the history of science from the University of California at Berkeley. I suppose, as we noticed, the universities with which he's been associated, he's already endeared to Stephen Heath and myself, who have made a study of Henry Eyring, and Henry was at Wisconsin and at Berkeley. In 1969 and 70, he served on the faculties of Andrews and Loma Linda Universities. He was named an assistant professor of the history of medicine and history of science in 1974 at Madison. He served as chairman of the department from 1977 to 1981. He's also had concurrent appointments as a fellow at the Menninger Foundation and a fellow in the Institute of the History of Medicine at Johns Hopkins University. He has written books on The Prophetess of Health, A Study of Ellen G. White, Creation by Natural Law, Laplace's Nebular Hypothesis in American Thought, and Almost Persuaded, American Physicians and Compulsory Health Insurance. He's involved in editing a number of books and in a number of research projects. One book which would be of interest to Mormons, I suppose, is God and Nature, A History of the Encounter Between Christianity and Science. He's editing this work with David C. Lindbergh of Madison. He is also doing a research project on the history of scientific defenses of creationism in the 20th century. A number of his awards, the Josiah Macy Jr. Foundation Fellowship in the History of Medicine and Biological Sciences, John Simon Guggenheim Foundation Fellowship in the National Science Foundation Scholars Award, which he presently holds. My first introduction to Dr. Numbers was 3 years ago when I was doing some research on Brigham Young's cosmology. As a background, I read his book on creation by natural law. I would highly recommend that to any of you present who are interested in these questions of science and religion. I might comment that Brigham Young would have raised the question, what other kind of creation is there? We may find that out today. His professional activities include the History of Science Society, the American Association for the History of Medicine, and the American Society of Church History. He's also an advisory editor to the Encyclopedia Americana. We're grateful for his presence in Salt Lake City. He's a scholar of very fine reputation. I was quite delighted when I discovered that he would be with us, and so I'd like to turn the time over to Dr. Numbers.
Thank you very much. I've been delighted to come to Salt Lake City for my first visit. Upon looking around and seeing the beautiful location that you have here, I've become convinced that Brigham Young, if not Joseph Smith, was inspired. The topic I'd like to discuss with you this morning is the dilemma of evangelical scientists. The dilemma in this case being how to reconcile one's scientific and religious beliefs. Now, for most Christians, this involves choosing between, on the one hand, a theory of special creation, miraculous special creation, or, on the other extreme, a version of theistic evolution. I think it's safe to say that for all Christians, at least for all evangelical Christians, the option of materialistic or atheistic evolution is not even present. As you might have gathered from the brief resume that you've just heard, I was raised and educated in a fundamentalist environment myself. I was an undergraduate science and mathematics major, and therefore have experienced to a certain extent this dilemma about which I am speaking this morning. On the other hand, I assure you that I will be talking strictly as a historian and will not add any more autobiographical material. Although the Mormon experience has been unique in some respects, I think there are a lot of parallels with what American evangelicals, fundamentalists, have gone through. In fact, Richard Sherlock, writing about Mormon reactions to Darwinism in the Journal of Mormon History not long ago, said, "Mormonism may have been less vociferous in its struggle, but the agonizing dilemma has been no less real." Well, with that preface, let me begin my paper. For more than a century, scientists of evangelical persuasion have lived simultaneously, often very uncomfortably, in two intellectual worlds. A religious world that insisted on the divine inspiration of the Genesis account of creation, and a scientific world that overwhelmingly accepted the truth of organic evolution. From the beginning, evangelicals responded to this situation in a variety of ways. The most conservative among them rejected the testimony of biologists and geologists in favor of a recent special creation in 6 24-hour days. While the more liberal evangelicals identified evolution as God's method of creating the world and interpreted Genesis figuratively. Still others took an intermediate position by postulating one or more acts of special creation in an otherwise evolutionary process, a view that came to be known in some circles as progressive creationism. My paper explores the efforts of evangelical scientists to come to terms with the issue of origins during the period between the end of the fundamentalist controversies of the 1920s, which left conservative Christians united in their opposition to evolution, but badly divided over the correct interpretation of Genesis, to the early 1980s, which found evangelicals less united in their opposition to evolution, but even more polarized theologically. Throughout my discussion, I use the term evangelical in an admittedly loose manner to designate that amorphous body of conservative Protestants who have believed, among other doctrines, that the Bible is the inspired Word of God, the only unerring guide to faith and conduct. Fundamentalists, according to my usage, are those who have occupied the militant right wing of the evangelical movement. Although all evangelical scientists professed faith in the inerrancy of the scriptures, they often disagreed over the meaning of the first chapters of Genesis. Some viewed the days of creation as representing great spans of time, each corresponding to successive epochs in the natural history of the world, and allowed for considerable evolutionary development. I think this was a view endorsed by the Mormon geologist Frederick Pack in the 1920s, but one not to be confused with another fairly common Mormon view that equated the days of Genesis with 1,000-year periods, which I believe is distinctive to the Mormon tradition, having not found it in any other evangelical literature. This day-age theory, as it's called, enjoyed great popularity among the leading evangelical scientists of the late 19th century, including such luminaries as Yale's geologist James Dwight Dana, the Canadian geologist John William Dawson, and George Frederick Wright, an early Christian Darwinist who later contributed, somewhat ironically, an essay on evolution to the Fundamentals, the series of pamphlets that gave the name to the fundamentalist movement. even such fundamentalist stalwarts as William Jennings Bryan and William Bell Riley found this view attractive. In fact, on the eve of the Scopes trial, Bryan confided in a letter to a friend that he had no objection to evolution before man, but for the fact that a concession as to the truth of evolution up to man furnishes our opponents with an argument which they are quick to use. Namely, if evolution accounts for all the species up to man, does it not raise a presumption in behalf of evolution to include man? Problems. Organic forms up to man, although he did not want the public to know about it. Other evangelical exegetes identified two separate creations in the first verses of Genesis. The first, in the beginning, billions of years ago, and the second in six actual days, approximately 4,000 years before the birth of Christ. According to this so-called gap theory, also known among some as the ruin and restitution theory, most fossils were relics of the first creation, destroyed by God prior to the Adamic restoration. The Schofield Reference Bible, which came out in 1909 and was a fundamentalist favorite, this particular view, as did the Presbyterian minister and self-styled research scientist Harry Rimmer, who, despite limited scientific training at a small homeopathic medical school in San Francisco, for decades ranked among the evangelical community's leading interpreters of science in the Bible. The most literal reading of Genesis, but a minority view among fundamentalists during the 1920s, and a small minority view among fundamentalists during this period, held that God created all terrestrial life, past and present, in six 24-hour days, about 6,000 years ago, and that a universal Noachian flood accounted for most of the fossil record. The leading exponent of this position was George McCready Price, a Seventh-day Adventist educator and self-trained geologist who regarded the day-age theory of evangelicals as the devil's counterfeit, and the gap theory is only slightly less objectionable. During the 1920s, Price emerged, according to the editor of Science, as the principal scientific authority of the fundamentalists. And for decades, his reputation continued to increase among the rank and file. By the 1950s, his influence had, in the opinion of one observer, reached staggering proportions, with his flood geology forming the backbone of much of fundamentalist thought about geology, creation, and the flood. Now, it's interesting to note that Price influenced creationist thought not only among those Americans who would be considered fundamentalists, but also among the most conservative synods of the Lutheran Church, and I might add, among Mormons as well, if my understanding of Mormon scientific history is correct.
It was Price's influence on Joseph Fielding Smith in the late 20s and early 30s that prompted Smith to stake out within Mormonism what might be called something very close to a fundamentalist interpretation of Genesis, and led ultimately to the publication in the early 1950s of his controversial book, Man, His Origin and Destiny. So I think that Mormons do owe George McCurdy Price a great intellectual debt. You may not want to acknowledge it. This failure of evangelicals to agree on such a vital issue as the interpretation of Genesis so disturbed some scholars, they resolved in the mid-1930s to create a united front against the theory of evolution by organizing a religion and science association to which all parties would be invited. One of the driving forces behind this undertaking was L. Allen Higley, a Wheaton College professor of chemistry and geology who had earned a PhD in organic chemistry from the University of Chicago. A non-denominational evangelical, he subscribed to the ruin and restitution theory of Genesis, and according to one associate, headed a large and enthusiastic group of non-sectarian creation religionists throughout the Middle West. Higley became the organization's first president, while George McCurdy Price, representing flood geology in this coalition, served as chairman of its board of directors. The secretary of this organization was a fiery and irascible creationist named Joseph Dudley Whitney, who, for some of you may know, in the 1930s published his views, which were Price's views, at the invitation of Joseph Fielding Smith in the Deseret News. Whitney had anticipated publishing a whole series of seven or eight essays out here. And for some reason, I think there was some controversy associated with his views, he only got one, which led him to say, had he had the opportunity to publish the entire series, he would have turned the Intermountain States into a creationist stronghold. The Religion and Science Association held its first and perhaps only meeting in the spring of 1936 in Chicago's Moody Memorial Chapel. The program reflected the association's irenic goals. Among the scheduled speakers were spokesmen for each of the three major creationist camps, including Price, Rimmer, and W. Bell Dawson, who, like his famous father, advocated the day-age theory of Genesis. Despite their laudable intentions, the leaders of the association soon discovered that their theological differences outweighed their common opposition to evolution. Higley's pre-Adamic theories are the most absurd which I've ever run across, wrote one of Price's disciples following a conversation with the society's president. He told me that Lucifer was the first being created on the world, and that he was put here several millions of years ago, and that his fall was the cause of several millions of years of chaos in which the earth was without form and void. That was the time when stratified rocks were laid down, and then in six 24-hour days, God recreated the earth and the habitations upon it. In the face of such revelations, the Price faction bolted the organization, leaving it in shambles. Disillusioned about the prospects of ever harmoniously working with creationists like Higley, Price and some like-minded friends, many of them Seventh-day Adventist physicians, in 1938 organized a deluge geology society in the Los Angeles area. As described by Price, this group consisted of a very eminent set of men. In no other part of this round globe could anything like the number of scientifically educated believers in creation and opponents of evolution be assembled as here in Southern California. The statement is true today as it was back in the late 30s. But in spite of the group's religious homogeneity, it too soon founded upon the same rock, complained a disappointed member, that had wrecked the Religion and Science Association, that is, pre-Genesis time for the earth. The third attempt to create a society of evangelical scientists in America proved more successful, at least for a time. 1941, the president of the Moody Bible Institute invited five evangelical scientists to Chicago to discuss the need for such an enterprise. From this meeting grew the American Scientific Affiliation, commonly known as the ASA, originally headed by F. Alton Everest, a professor of engineering at Oregon State College. Although the society took no official stand on the evolution question, members were required to sign a doctrinal statement attesting to their belief in the inspiration of the Bible. And Everest reportedly assured one early recruit that the ASA would be anti-evolutionary. Certainly, the association's first book, entitled Modern Science and Christian Faith, which appeared in 1948, reflected this anti-evolutionary orientation, containing, as it did, a strong anti-evolutionary chapter by two biologists, Walter Lammert, a follower of Price's, and William Tinkle. Within a decade of its founding, membership in the ASA had grown from 5 to 220, over half of whom belonged to the Mennonite, Baptist, or Presbyterian churches and resided in the Middle Atlantic or Midwestern states. By the late 1940s, the ASA was beginning to show signs of tension, brought on in part by the growing presence of some young, well-trained scientists who wanted to bring evangelical Christianity more into line with mainstream science. The most vocal of this group was J. Lawrence Culp, a geochemist who took Price and his followers to task for their unscientific effort to squeeze Earth history into less than 10,000 years. A Wheaton alumnus and member of the Plymouth Brethren, Culp had acquired a PhD in physical chemistry from Princeton University and completed all but a dissertation in geology before joining the faculty of Columbia University, where he had, at the beginning, a two-year postdoc in geology. Culp, by the way, was the first person in the world to apply the techniques of carbon-14 dating to geology and paleontology. Despite his fundamentalist upbringing, he had come to accept the testimony of geology regarding the history and antiquity of the earth. And being one of the first evangelicals professionally trained in the science of geology, he felt a responsibility to warn his colleagues in the ASA about the scientific flaws in Price's views. Already, he feared that Price's ideas had infiltrated the greater portion of fundamental Christianity in America, primarily due to the absence of trained Christian geologists. Conservatives within the ASA not unreasonably suspected that Culp's exposure to the orthodox geological viewpoint had eroded his faith in a literal interpretation of the Bible. Indeed, it had. Similar suspicion greeted Cornelia Erdman's announcement in the early 1950s that she, too, an instructor in geology at Wheaton College. By the way, this Wheaton College is the evangelical college in Illinois, the alma mater of Billy Graham, not Wheaton College in Massachusetts, at least there's any confusion. She accepted the conclusions of geologists regarding the overall sequence in which organic forms have made their appearance, which she contrasted with the pseudo-scientific findings of the Price School. Although she stopped far short of embracing general organic evolution, critics immediately questioned her orthodoxy. Ms. Erdman's paper is a fair statement of the position of the standard geologist, noted the fundamentalist biologist Tinkle. However, he went on, the standard geologist is an evolutionist. Before long, it became evident that a growing number of ASA members, like Culp and Erdman, were drifting from strict to progressive creationism and often on to theistic evolution. Indisputable evidence of this shift came to light in an annual meeting in 1957 when Russell Mixter, a zoologist on the faculty of Wheaton College, conceded the evolution not only of species, but of whole orders of plants and animals. In essence, wrote one admirer of mixtures, he had declared that I, an evangelical Christian, can accept the basic concepts of evolution. Although not exclusively demanded by the data involved, it is certainly allowed. And in fact, I can see no better or more logical way to handle the data. I believe in creation and simply affirm that in the light of the evidence now available, I think some evolution, that is, development of present-day forms by differentiation of previously existing forms, the most likely way God accomplished much of his creation. Mixter's candid remarks touched off a spirited debate over the relative merits of progressive creation and theistic evolution that continued for over a year. The upshot, reported one troubled ASA member, appeared to be a growing conviction that inexorable pressures of expanding knowledge is about to force us to accept some formulation of the theory of evolution, including the evolutionary origin of man, and that we must adjust our thinking in accordance with this eventuality. Additional evidence of the ASA's drift from strict creationism appeared in 1959, when the association published a collection of essays, Evolution and Christian Thought Today, marking the centennial of the publication of Darwin's famous Origin of Species. Edited by Mixter, the volume made a clean break with what one contributor called the hyper-traditionalist interpretation of Genesis, including such notions as a young earth, a universal flood, and the absolute fixity of species. A few of the authors openly espoused theistic evolution. For example, biochemists Walter Hearn and Richard Hendry, who described Genesis as a beautifully poetic narrative, argued that Christians must be willing to accept that life arose from inanimate matter through a series of physical-chemical processes no different from those that we observe today. Such thinking strained evangelical theology to its limits and prompted some conservative reviewers to question whether the book, and by implication the ASA, represented evangelical thinking at all. By 1960, it was clear to most observers that the ASA had experienced something of an intellectual revolution within its ranks. In 15 years, wrote one member sympathetic to this change, we have seen develop within the ASA a spectrum of belief in evolution that would have shocked all of us at the inception of our organization. This shift, it seems, resulted less from the discovery of new scientific evidence in favor of evolution, although some have come along, such as new forms of dating, less from this type of evidence, I think, than from a growing familiarity with evolutionary theory gained in part from advanced education. More and more fundamentalist and evangelical students were going to institutions of higher learning, a problem paralleled within the Mormon tradition. Although knowledge is expanding, said Frank Tassel, I would judge that it is not the new information as much as the better understanding through more honest consideration of the old that accounts for the shift of emphasis by ASA members with respect to evolution. Heightened scientific consciousness, however, explains only part of the transition. For Bible-believing Christians, it was also important that any new position on evolution be scripturally as well as scientifically sound. Fortunately for them, evangelical scholars such as Bernard Ram offered just the theological validation they wanted and needed. In 1954, Ram, a Baptist theologian and philosopher of science, published a path-breaking work entitled The Christian View of Science and Scripture, in which he castigated the Christ school for its narrow bibliolatry and for its perversion of true Christianity, arguing that evangelicals need not believe in a young earth, a universal flood, or even in the recent appearance of human beings. Although Ram personally favored a progressive creation model, he allowed for considerable evolutionary development and granted the orthodoxy of even theistic evolution. His influential work offered restless ASA scientists the very theological freedom their scientific studies led them to demand. And as one of the theistic evolutionists confessed, naturally, when I see the need of more time, and some biblical scholar says, sure, you may have more time, I tend to jump on his bandwagon very quickly. Ram, who dedicated his book to Everett, the founder of the ASA, and acknowledged the assistance of Culp, thus became the theological guru of the ASA, which published a special issue of its journal in his honor on the occasion of the 25th anniversary of his book. For most evangelical scientists, giving up strict creationism involved immense personal stress. J. Frank Castle, who went on from Wheaton College to become chairman of the Department of Zoology at North Dakota State University, and is presently teaching biology at the Air Force Academy, captured some of the turmoil in the following autobiographical testimony. First to be overcome was the onus of dealing with a verboten term and in a non-existent area. Then, as each made an honest and objective consideration of the data, he was struck with the validity and undeniability of datum after datum. As he strove to incorporate each of these facts into his biblical scientific frame of reference, he found that while the frame became more complete and satisfying, he began to question first the feasibility and then the desirability of an effort to refute the total evolutionary concept, and finally he became impressed by its impossibility on the basis of existing data. This has been a heart-rending, soul-searching experience for the committed Christian, as he has seen what he has long considered his raison d'etre of God's call for his life endeavor fade away, and as he has struggled to release strongly held convictions as to the close limitations of creationism. Castle went on to note that the struggle was made no easier by the lack of approbation, much less acceptance, of some of his less well-informed colleagues, some of whom seemed to question motives as well as to imply heresy. As these comments suggest, the pain suffered by Frank Castle and his friends elicited little sympathy from the conservatives within the ASA, who thought the association had gone soft on evolution, or, in the colorful phrase of one member, had gone to the apes. In their opinion, the drift toward evolution was motivated not by intellectual honesty, but by the malignant influence of that old serpent called the devil and Satan, which deceiveth the whole world. The term progressive creation they regarded as merely a euphemism for heterodox theistic evolution, the acceptance of which, declared one critic, was tantamount to placing a kiss of death on the master. Assurances that even theistic evolutionists believed in God as creator, and efforts to distinguish between evolution as a biological theory and evolutionism as a quasi-religious worldview, all failed to allay the suspicion of heresy. Now, the ASA liberals, for their part, displayed equally little charity toward the plight of the conservatives. Often self-conscious about their own fundamentalist heritage, and increasingly embarrassed by the anti-evolution rhetoric of their creationist colleagues, they damned strict creationism as pseudoscience and a menace to true Christian faith. By the early 1960s, a split between liberals and conservatives, mirroring the rift that had already divided the larger evangelical community into fundamentalist and neo-evangelical camps, appeared inevitable. The intellectual leader of the creationist insurgents was a Southern Baptist engineer, Henry Morris, who as a young adult had embraced Price's flood geology as a means of harmonizing science and the Bible. In the late 1940s, he had joined the ASA just in time to protest Larry Culp's attack on George McCready Price's views. But Morris's words had fallen on deaf ears. In 1953, when he presented some of his own opinions to the ASA, one of the few compliments came from a young theologian, John C. Whitcomb, Jr., who belonged to the Grace Brethren. These two creationists, Morris and Whitcomb, subsequently decided to collaborate on a major defense of the Noachian flood. By the time they finished their project, Morris had earned a PhD in hydraulic engineering from the University of Minnesota and was chairing the civil engineering department at Virginia Polytechnic Institute. Whitcomb was teaching Old Testament studies at Grace Theological Seminary in Indiana. In 1961, they brought out the Genesis Flood, which in my opinion is the most impressive contribution to strict creationism since the 1920s, and which I noticed a few minutes ago is displayed in your book section back here, if anybody wants to run out and buy it. It's a classic. In many respects, their book appeared to be simply a reissue of G.M. Price's views brought up to date, as one reader aptly described it. Beginning with a testimony to their belief in the verbal inerrancy of Scripture, Morris and Whitcomb went on to argue for a recent creation of the entire universe, going beyond Price in this respect, a fall that triggered the second law of thermodynamics, and a worldwide flood that in 1 year laid down most of the geological strata. Given this history, they argued, the last refuge of the case for evolution immediately vanishes away, and the record of the rocks becomes a tremendous witness to the holiness and justice and power of the living God of creation. Despite their book's lack of conceptual novelty, it provoked an intense debate among evangelicals. Progressive creationists and theistic evolutionists denounced it as a travesty on geology that threatened to set back the cause of Christian Science a generation, while strict creationists praised it for making biblical catastrophism intellectually respectable. Its appeal, suggested one critic, lay primarily in the fact that unlike previous creationist works, that maybe a graph that produced poor quality, this one looked legitimate as a scientific contribution, accompanied as it was by footnotes and other scholarly appurtenances. In responding to their detractors, Morris and Whitcomb repeatedly refused to be drawn into a scientific debate, arguing instead that the real issue is not the correctness of the interpretation of various details of the geological data, but simply what God has revealed in His Word concerning these matters. Those of you familiar with what is called creation science today will know the contrast. Whatever its merits, the Genesis flood unquestionably brought about a stunning renaissance of flood geology and created an intellectual climate conducive to the establishment of a scientific society for strict creationists only. Shortly before the publication of his book, Morris had sent the manuscript to the Lutheran geneticist Walter Lammerts, a fellow ASA member who for a time had worked with Price in the Deluge Geology Society. Disgusted by the ASA's flirtation with evolution and encouraged by Morris and Whitcomb's manuscript, Lammerts in the early 1960s organized a correspondence network dubbed the Team of Ten, which included Morris and eight other strict creationists. 1963, seven of the ten met with a few others of like mind at the home of a team member in Midland, Michigan to form the Creation Research Society, the CRS. The society began with a carefully selected 18-man inner core steering committee, including the original team of 10, the composition of which reflected, albeit imperfectly, the denominational, regional, and professional bases of the creationist revival. Of the 17 members for whom information could be found, six were Missouri Synod Lutherans, five Baptists, two Seventh-day Adventists, and one each from the Reformed Presbyterian Church, the Reformed Church, Christian Church, the Church of the Brethren, and an independent Bible church. No Mormons to be found among the CRS leadership, at least. Which, maybe you can tell me why this is not happening. 11 lived in the Midwest, 3 in the South, and 2 in the Far West. The committee included 6 biologists, but only 1 geologist, an independent consultant with a master's degree. 7 members taught in church-related college, 5 in state institutions, the rest worked for industry or were self-employed. Now, to avoid the creeping evolutionism that had rent the ASA, and to ensure that their society remained loyal to strict creationism, the CRS required members to sign a statement of belief accepting the inerrancy of the Bible, the special creation of all types of living things, and a worldwide deluge. To legitimize its claim to being a scientific society, it published a quarterly journal and limited full membership to persons possessing a graduate degree in some scientific discipline. At the end of its first decade, the society claimed 450 regular members, plus 1,600 sustaining members who failed to meet the scientific qualifications. Eschewing politics, the CRS devoted itself almost exclusively to education and research, funded, as they proudly noted, at very little expense and with no expenditure of public money. They would like to get public money. Society-related projects included expeditions to search for Noah's Ark, studies of fossil human footprints and pollen grains found out of the predicted evolutionary order, experiments on radiation-produced mutations in plants, and theoretical studies in physics demonstrating a recent origin of the Earth. In addition, a number of members collaborated in preparing a biology textbook based on creationist principles. And in view of the previous history of such organizations, this was indeed an auspicious beginning. During the 70s and early 80s, strict creationists mounted a remarkably successful campaign to carry their message beyond scientific societies like the CRS to the masses. In addition to persuading 2 state legislatures and various local school boards to require the teaching of their interpretation of Genesis, they stemmed and perhaps even reversed the drift of evangelical Christians toward theistic evolution. A survey in 1979 revealed that American evangelicals believed by almost an 8-to-1 margin that God created Adam and Eve to start human life. Such a statement did not preclude the acceptance of progressive creationism, but it certainly ruled out theistic evolution. In recent years, various writers have noted a marked tendency among evangelicals to believe in a recent creation and universal flood. The minority position advocated by Price in the 1920s, there has, if you haven't gathered it, been a tremendous intellectual shift within the evangelical fundamentalist community in the years between 1920s and 1960s, 80s. In fact, the advocates of a young earth so successfully identified their views with creationism, they co-opted the very term creationism, forcing other creationists into reluctantly giving up the label. In the preface to his book on Christianity and the Age of the Earth, published in 1982, the evangelical geologist Davis A. Young explained why, despite believing in creation, he intended to argue against creationism. I regret the fact that in this book I must call those with whose views I disagree creationists, because I am a creationist, and I believe the biblical record of creation. Unfortunately, however, those who advocate the creation of the world in 7 literal days only a few thousand years ago have come to be known generally as creationists. Similarly, in the late 1970s, an ASA officer explained that while his association was, quote, a creationist group in the biblical sense of the term, its members were not generally considered to be true blue creationists in the most restricted use of the term that has come into being in the last 5 or 10 years. Indeed, the language of creationism has evolved so much that were he alive today, even William Jennings Bryan, once the leader of American creationists, would not qualify as a creationist. Many factors contributed to the resurgence of strict creationism. Its conformity to a common sense reading of the Bible, its uncompromising attitude toward evolution, and the skill with which men like Morris and his associates presented it as a scientifically respectable option. Ironically, in recent years, strict creationists who derive their views from the Bible have begun calling their teachings creation science, just as many liberal evangelicals who read Genesis through evolutionary lenses once insisted on being regarded as creationists, progressive creationists. If you call something a rose, you expect it to smell like a rose, explained the sagacious Russell Mixter, who insisted that nobody refer to him as a theistic evolutionist, but a progressive creationist. It takes an informed person to distinguish between the two. In view of their many victories, it would be easy to overestimate the influence of the strict creationists. While it is true that they cultivated a large following in evangelical churches of America, they nevertheless failed, by and large, to capture evangelical colleges, many of which continued to provide sanctuary for scientists of a more liberal inclination. A survey in the 1970s of faculty who taught science in the Christian College Consortium showed that the majority of the science faculty members take either a progressive creationist or theistic evolutionist position. And from my limited familiarity with the Mormon scene, I take it that's probably true of the BYU biologists, who would tend to be much more liberal, perhaps, in the rank and file. By the early 1980s, the evangelical community was probably more deeply divided over the issue of evolution than at any time in its history. Compared with the 1920s, when anti-evolutionists papered over their theological differences, at least in public, recent years have found evangelical scientists split into two hostile camps, neither of which makes much of an effort to accommodate the other. But some things remain unchanged. Many evangelical scientists continue to find themselves, like their forebears, living uncomfortably in two separate worlds. I feel something of a stranger in two quite different worlds. Two worlds of which I, as one of God's creatures, am very much a part, revealed the Australian D. Gareth Jones in a poignant personal testimony. It is this sense of alienation which is at the heart of my personal dilemma.
Time is up, so since there's no questions anyway, we will thank you for your attendance.